There's a professor at MIT who wants to build a time machine. Grant McCracken is working on a conceptual device that will help us get to the future faster by understanding the trends that are shaping the world to come. McCracken told Steve Paulson why we need to get better at looking ahead.
Are trend forecasters actually good at predicting trends?
I think they're trying as hard as they can. The difficulty is that the future that Alvin Toffler told us 40 years ago was becoming less and less kind of scrutable has in fact fulfilled his promise and then some. So trend spotting, in point of fact now, it's a painfully difficult undertaking.
Why? Just because the trends change more often than they used to?
Right. Well, the metaphor I like to use is standing on the beach and watching the big rollers come in. In the 1950s, contemporary culture was well enough organized that that's what the future looked like, and you could spot your wave, you could make ready. And that orderliness existed because there were relatively small elites calling the shots from a cultural point of view. You know, what mattered in terms of fiction or movie making or clothing design. And that world is thoroughly past, so that now some kid in the northern part of Japan with an internet connection and a community established through new media can now make a difference to contemporary culture. Or he may not, and that's kind of the trend spotter's difficulty, picking out of all this noise what is the future. So in the place of those big, clear breakers rolling to shore, the waters are being driven in all directions. That process of pattern recognition is now really tough.
Well, and it seems that every cultural group, every news organization, every blog for that matter, it kind of identifies itself as a trend spotter. But it raises the question of what actually is a trend.
Right. That is the question. I mean, just to use an example, you know, we've seen the world of American cuisine transformed by what we might call the artisanal trend. And by this time, we can say unambiguously that it is a trend and what the trend is and how the trend works.
You're talking about the kind of artisanal cuisine going back to Alice Waters, Chez Panisse, that kind of local cooking,
exactly.
All that.
Local production and foodstuffs made in tiny quantities by somebody whose first name you know. And it, in turn, is being overturned by something. And in these very early days, it's hard to say what. If we're looking at things as they've just appeared, or just as they're beginning to contemplate the possibility of appearing, it's really hard to see what is a trend. Even the people who are creating it, even they are not quite sure what it is they're doing. They're operating as artists often do, acting out of a deep sense of their own intuition and playing out things without being capable of saying at the moment of creation exactly what it is they're creating. So in the early days, we can't know what a trend is, and we kind of have to wait until it's been embraced by a lot of people before we can say, yes, this is a trend.
I would think part of the difficulty here is figuring out what time scale we're working with. Political trends, economic trends often take a long time to evolve. Music, fashion, I mean, that can change very fast. And then you have Twitter. How do you figure out what is a significant trend and what is, you know, just going to be here today and gone tomorrow?
Yeah.
Perhaps we need to slow down when we're trying to identify trends. I mean, you actually talk about the importance of slow trends, which almost cuts against the very idea of identifying trends.
Yeah, it totally makes me the party pooper. And I think you could argue, if I can use Malcolm Gladwell's name on my own behalf, you know, I think that was his implicit complaint when he wrote his article about cool hunting, was that to some extent, trend hunters were more interested in being hip than they were in being right. And that's the great frustration for the organization, is that very often the trend hunter can tell you precisely what the hip stuff is, but they cannot tell you about anything that isn't hip. And there's just a vast amount of American culture, maybe 90% of American culture, falls outside of the hipness domain.
Well, it would seem that trends matter in an obvious sense for those who want to make money off of them, marketers or, you know, people who want to sell stuff to cater to the new cool. But once you get past that, do trends really matter?
Yeah, I think they do. I mean, if we imagine ourselves a not-for-profit like a hospital administrator, dealing with the very practical problem of patients who do not comply with the regimes they've been assigned. This kind of self-medication, self identification of illness. That's been a huge trend, let's say, for the last 20 years. That's a cultural trend that I think a hospital administrator deeply needs to know about, because he or she is grappling with this problem of patient compliance.
It's interesting that you use that example, because I mean, what you're really describing is a changing mindset. That kind of discussion usually falls outside talk about trends.
Perhaps it does, and you've spotted exactly how an anthropologist can make him or herself useful is by saying, you know, this is part of a bigger intellectual problem.
Well, I guess the question then is trend spotting or predicting trends, is this more art or science?
I think it's some combination of the two. And I'm just on the verge of teaching a course at MIT in which we kind of try to build a conceptual, not a computational, a conceptual model of what I'm calling a kind of time machine, something you use to examine the past and to make projections about the future. So even if this course turns out brilliantly and everybody does an exquisitely useful job of building the model, it'll still be more art than science.
Well, it's interesting that you say that what you're trying to do is something beyond the computational, because, I mean, there are people who basically try to plug all the factors into a computer and figure out the algorithm to predict a trend. Yeah. But you're saying that maybe you have to do more than that.
Yeah, I think I'm not hostile to the idea of a quantitative approach. If and when we can have access to that kind of clarity and that kind of precision, we want to. But in these early days, a lot of the pattern recognition is, and this is where it gets much more art than science, it's people living with the data for a long time and then listening for patterns to kind of emerge in their own thinking. That drives scientists crazy because it is so imprecise, it's so intuitive. But until we build these bigger, better models, we leave to our unconscious powers of cognition this pattern recognition.
Can you elaborate on this? I mean, this idea of building some sort of a time machine, what would be the elements of this?
So let's use as a case in point that artisanal trend we were talking about. That is the result of many things, many long arcs. What do we have as measures? We have a few books that sold well. We have a few people who became nutritional gurus. It's not until 71, when Alice Waters creates Chez Panisse in Berkeley, that we have a really something we can put on our radar and then start tracking. We can draw a pretty direct line from that restaurant to what Michelle Obama did when she installed a vegetable garden on the lawn of the White House a couple of years ago. You know, there's a nice clear connection between those two things. And the art of this model has to be, how quickly could you pick that restaurant out of the ether? You know, at what point? Is it 81? Is it 91? Is it 2001 that you begin to say, this is something?
And ultimately, and, just to take that example, it's not about just Alice Waters. For it to become a trend, other people have to grab onto this idea that artisanal food is important.
Totally, totally. Many people and forces and institutions participate in this forming of the trend. But that this transition took place is, I think, maybe a good example of how kind of volatile our culture is. We're fantastically changeable, and virtually everything, including gender identity, is on the table. For anthropological purposes, that's just fantastically interesting.
Hmm. Why do you think we're so obsessed with trends? And there are two sides to this. I mean, one are those people who want to be the early adopters. I mean, they love trends.
Right.
They want to jump on
right.
the latest thing. And other people hate them. I mean, they want to buck the trends. But either way, people are paying attention.
I think we are asked to stay current, and it's a little like the train is always about to leave the station. You know, I think we pay attention because this is sort of the price of citizenship in the culture that's emerging.
I have to ask you, what do you think are the really important trends right now? What do you see coming 20 years from now? Or let's say 5 years from now, make it a little bit easier.
I mean, I guess the trend that's been upon us for some years now, and this is just the constant fragmentation of our culture, that feels like it will grow apace. It used to be that organizations would have a while to think about something that looked like it might matter to the way they defined themselves. And now it can install itself in an afternoon in May. You know, it's just not there, and then it is there. I mean, I don't know if you've had this sensation. I have it all the time because I try to keep track of the whole of the waterfront of contemporary culture. But you'll find yourself party to a conversation where people are using someone's name, and it's a film or it's an actor or it's a skateboard stunt, and they're using it like you must know this.
Yeah. Oh, it happens all the time. Yeah.
The new media makes it possible for us just to listen to people like us and to live in our own, as it were, trend bubble. And that creates the specter of a culture that dissolves into little solipsisms, you know, worlds of meaning that are indifferent to the presence of other worlds of meaning and treat themselves as the only center of gravity that should matter for anybody. That's a scary prospect. You know, at the moment we have lots of little worlds, but the worlds remain more or less, not always, in shouting distance of one another. And is it possible that the gravitational field that keeps these worlds within shouting distance fails or falls silent, and these worlds begin to drift away from one another? That's quite scary.
Well, given all the fragmentation, if we don't really see these trends, what are the dangers we face?
I guess we can disaggregate. And maybe we're seeing that in American politics now, where we have left and right talking to themselves and not to one another. And what you hear when people from the left and the right get together to have discussions, one or both parties will say, "You just don't get it," which is a fantastic, for anthropological purposes, a great signature of the fact that we're talking about mutually exclusive worlds of meaning, separate cultures, as it were. And we see how fantastically damaging it is in the political realm. You know, the ordinary business of politics stops effectively. Maybe the future has arrived on that one.
Grant McCracken teaches anthropology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His latest book is Culturematic. He talked with Steve Paulson.